And welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Kicking with Keeler here on the Full Press Radio Network, episode number 11 of Kicking with Keeler. So thanks for hopping back with us here on a Thursday, whether you're listening live or listening on download or whenever we air the show during the week. We definitely appreciate it. I'm your host, Ricky Keeler, and we have a jam-packed show for you the next hour. So much has gone on in the world of sports this week. It's so hard to jam into it an hour, but we'll try our best to do it. We've got the Astros sign-stealing scandal with the punishments laid out. We've got the wrap-up of the divisional round, the NFL, previewing the conference championships, LSU wins the national championship in football, in college football, and you have the Odell Beckham situation where he's handing out money to LSU players, and now he's in trouble with the police for smacking the behind of a police officer. That's some crazy stuff. So much going on in sports. You got Zion Williamson's coming back next week, and Josh Donaldson signs a big deal with the Twins, a four-year deal to help their offense. But a lot to get into in the world of sports this week. We have two big guests here for the next hour, and we're excited to do that. We're going to have Patrick Creighton from ESPN Radio in Houston and SB Nation Radio to give us the landscape on not just the Astros. We're going to talk Houston Texans, because when you blow a 24-0 lead in the span of a quarter, you're going to get attention. We're going to have a lot of blame on the Texans. You're going to get a lot of great takes from Patrick. It was a lot of fun to record that interview, so I'm excited to get to have you guys hear it. And then we're going to have Ryan Advert-Dorada later on. He's the editor of Full Press 49ers. We're going to preview the Niners-Packers NFC Championship game coming up Sunday night at 6:40 on Fox from an NFC, a Niners perspective in the NFC. So Ryan will give us his take there. If you want to contribute to the show, there's a variety of ways you can do so. You can tweet me on Twitter at Rickinator555. It's at R-I-C-K, letter I, Nader like in Terminator 555. You can tweet the radio station on Twitter at Full Press Radio, or tweet Full Press Coverage at FP Coverage. We have great sites for NBA, MLB, NHL, college football, wrestling. We got everything at Full Press Coverage. So feel free to take the time to check out any of those sites. Also, this podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. So if you're on iTunes, subscribe to the podcast. Give it a rating, 1 star, 5 star. Give your feedback. I'm always happy to hear feedback on the show. So feel free to do so. I'll gladly appreciate it. So I'm going to start with the Astros sign-stealing scandal, and then we're going to get to my interview with Patrick. Of course, the punishment's handed down by Rob Manfred this week. Jim Crane, the Astros owner, got a $5 million fine. The Astros lost their first and second round draft picks over the next 2 years. Jeff Luhnow and A.J. Hinch, Jeff Luhnow being the GM, A.J. Hinch the manager, suspended for a year, but Crane decided to fire them, which I think he had to do it. And you have Alex Cora, who's now waiting for discipline from Manfred from not only this, but from the 2018 Red Sox sign-stealing issue. You have the Red Sox and Cora mutually agreeing to part ways. You have earlier today the Mets and Carlos Beltran mutually agreeing to part ways. Beltran, the only player listed in the 9-page report. Remember, Manfred told the players, basically, if you cooperate, you get immunity. And I think you look at this punishments from Rob Manfred, and I understand people saying, well, they went too light. But at the same time, what did you expect Major League Baseball to do? I mean, think about this for a second. They gave the owner a $5 million fine, which is the largest you can give him under the MLB Constitution. So they punished Jim Crane as much as they possibly could. They took away two draft picks over the next 2 years, so they lose 4 picks total. That's huge. Maybe not for this year's team and next year's team, it could hurt a farm system over the next 5 years if you can't bring in top talent in the first 2 rounds of a draft. So while it doesn't immediately hurt the team now, it's going to hurt them down the road. They lost their manager. They got to go on a managerial search, just like the Red Sox do now, the Mets do. Lost a general manager. Got to go on a GM search. Do they stay internal or do they go external? And for people who are saying they should take the ring away or take the title away, we can't pretend stuff didn't happen in sports. We all watched it. I root for the Yankees. I'm not sitting here saying the Yankees should now be the AL champions. They lost that series because they couldn't score runs. The Astros, to me, won the title. Now it's going to come. You're going to have to, down the road, as they went to talk about the Astros won in 2017, explain what happened. Teach people that this happened down the road. You don't have to have an asterisk on everything. So what? You have an asterisk on it. Those players know they won. It's like when you take a title away in college sports, it doesn't mean anything. You can't erase memories. You can't. So to me, when you take a look at this whole thing in the grand scheme of things, and a bad job by Jessica Mendoza, who was an advisor for the Mets, she went on ESPN Radio on Thursday morning, basically blamed Mike Fiers for it. Mike Fiers did the right thing in going to the Athletic and Ken Rosenthal and Evan Drellick, who have done an excellent job in this reporting. Tim Brown of Yahoo, by the way, was the first to report on the Beltran news earlier today. I thought the Red Sox did the right thing with Alex Cora. They were right on top of it. They could not bring him back. I think Cora is going to get at least 2 years, one for each scandal. You can't have a manager come back after 2 years, so Alex Cora had to go. But I think here's where it comes down to with the Mets. And I have family who are Mets fans. They've been angry about this. I totally understand why they are angry. The Mets were in a lose-lose situation. They screwed it up. They waited till Thursday when this report came out on Monday to even talk about it. They said in their statement today with the mutually agreeing to part ways that Carlos Beltran was honest and forthcoming with them. So if Carlos Beltran was honest and forthcoming with them, why doesn't he have a job? Because you're afraid of the media? Because you're afraid of the circus that's going to come with it? I get the credibility be lost from Beltran by players for what he did. But if he's honest with you from the get-go, yes, he lied to Joel Sherman, but he told the truth to investigators. And he told the truth apparently to you. If that is the case, then why isn't Carlos Beltran still the manager? Why does he have to make a statement he's stepping down before you come out with anything? Like Jeff Wilpon's at the Mike Piazza Way ceremony in Port St. Lucie, and the second someone asked him a Beltran question, he's like, no, we're not here for that. Because you didn't address it before that. The Mets were in a lose-lose situation from day one. Day one. And they managed to mess it up more. Because 50-50 is either you, half the fan base was going to be mad that Beltran was let go, the other half would have been happy with it. There was not going to be 100% that people were going to agree on this, and there's still not 100% that people are agreeing on this. People are upset that Carlos Beltran's even implicated because none of the other players are, and I get that. But this is where being a de facto player coach hurt Carlos Beltran. He was viewed as that veteran leader in the clubhouse. And that hurt him in this case. It hurts Alex Cora's credibility that he's going to be now part of two scandals in 2 years, both with World Series championships. But you're not going to take the Red Sox title away. I think the only other thing that Rob Manfred could have done was added international signing penalties to the Astros. They couldn't improve heavily on international signings. When you make those amateur international signings, is what I mean. But I thought Manfred did a great job in calling out the bad culture Jeff Luhnow said, that Jeff Luhnow had put on the Astros. The whole Brandon Taubman incident, the thing with Anthony Fenech and not allowing him to talk to Justin Verlander. Jeff Luhnow created a bad culture in Houston that pride itself only on winning. And that's it. So when you look at everything, I don't think Luhnow will get another job. You'll hear Patrick's opinion on it in a little bit. I think AJ Hinch will get another job because he at least said I should have stopped it, even though AJ Hinch broke a monitor. He never actually tried to stop it. This incident is far from going away. I think the Mets have to bring in a veteran manager. However, I wouldn't be surprised if they brought in Eduardo Perez, who they interviewed, or Luis Rojas, who they interviewed. They love Luis Rojas in that organization. He's worked with a lot of their younger players. But I thought the Mets screwed up with Carlos Beltran, and I didn't think they were. I thought they were going to screw up anyway. They screwed up worse than I thought. And I'm a big Carlos Beltran fan. Yes, he made a mistake. At least he came out today, was honest about his mistake. He said, over my to Marley Rivera of ESPN, over my 20 years in the game, I've always taken pride in being a leader and doing things the right way. And in this situation, I failed. As a veteran player on the team, I should have recognized the severity of the issue and truly regret the actions that were taken. I am a man of faith and integrity, and what took place did not demonstrate those characteristics that are so very important to me and my family. I'm very sorry. It's not who I am as a father, a husband, a teammate, and as an educator. The Mets organization and I mutually agreed to part ways, moving forward for the greater good. with no further distractions. I hope that at some point in time, I'll have the opportunity to return to this game that I love so much. And I think eventually Beltran will return to the game. I think he's loved in the game. I think people respect him. I don't think this really changes anything. But there's a lot going on, and I can't wait to see what Jose Altuve, Alex Bregman, Carlos Correa, and some of these players have to say about this, because they've got a lot to talk about now. They do. And they were openly putting it in your face when they won, and rightfully so. But you guys cheated. You guys cheated. So it'll be interesting to see what the Astros players do, how they respond. This is still a good baseball team. They're still going to be good in 2020. They're going to be probably the second best team in the American League, if not second, third, probably. So they're still going to be a contender. But how they handle this, who they hire as manager, who the Red Sox hire as manager, will be interesting, and who the Mets hire will be as well. And there's only less than 3 days till spring training. So without further ado, let me get into my conversation with Patrick Creighton. Again, you can catch Patrick on ESPN 975 in Houston. You can also catch him on SB Nation Radio on the overnights during the week. Patrick was a great interview. We'll not only get into the Astros, we'll get into the Houston Texans. And after my interview with Patrick, we're going to talk about the NFL playoffs on the other side, and then later we'll do some college football. So without further ado, let's get to my conversation with Patrick. And Al on Kicking It with Keeler is a man that I know is going to give us the buzz on what's going down in Houston, because he talks to people on Houston Sports Talk Radio weeknights on late hits on ESPN 975 in Houston, also hosts Straight Heat on SB Nation Radio. Please welcome Patrick Creighton to the show. Patrick, how are you today?
Doing all right, brother. What's going on?
I'm doing pretty good. I gotta say, you must not have a hard time coming up with content this week.
I will tell you that in the past, it has been more difficult.
Fair enough. So before we get into the specifics of the everything with the Astros, what was your initial reaction to the punishments? Too lenient? Right? Just right? Too harsh? What do you think?
Well, the punishment matched up exactly with what had been reported, what was expected. You know, the idea of 1 year suspensions for Hinch and Luno, the $5 million fine, the loss of the draft picks. These are all things that, you know, had been reported as much as like a month, month and a half earlier. So I think it was right in line with what was expected. It is for baseball, for what their tradition, what their history is, it's a very stiff punishment. When you think about, you took away the two most important guys for the on-field management of the team. You talk away the top two picks for the next two drafts. The $5 million fine, I understand. It's, look, Jim Crane's a gazillionaire, and he's probably got that, you know, in his suit pocket. Not that big a deal. But it's the most that baseball's allowed to fine someone. So they hit him with the max. I thought it was as strong a punishment as baseball could give. You know, Rob Manfred has been saying for months, well, been saying for years, if you get caught after, you know, that September 2017, when he fined the Yankees and the Red Sox, if you get caught, I'm going to bring down the hammer. Well, they got caught. And they got hammered.
Yeah, I agree with you, Patrick. I think it's largely because what did people expect to happen? I mean, there's only so much that Rob Manfred could punish a team. Like you said, the $5 million is the highest you could fine an owner. Well, that's what Jim Crane got fined. Luno and Hinch were going to get suspended. That's the way it is. I don't get people talking about vacating a title. It's not like Major League Baseball is college basketball. I've seen it. It happened. The Astros player can still wear the rings and say, hey, we won this thing called the World Series. Just because it's in a book that says it's vacated, it doesn't really do anything for me in retrospect, because you're not going to hand it to the Dodgers. So I never got the people that are saying, oh, take the title from them.
That's basically people who are morons. I mean, we're just going to be fair about it. You know, professional sports doesn't vacate titles. Are we going to go back and take away titles from all the teams that use PED guys? You know, oh, they were cheating, so let's take away their titles. Are we going to go back into the 60s and 70s and take away titles from everybody who used amphetamines, guys? Oh, they were cheating. Take away the titles. You know, if you're a baseball historian and you follow the, you know, the stories about, you know, were the where the Giants using a spyglass, you know, that ultimately led to Bobby Thompson's home run off Frank Branca. Are we going to take away the, you know, the Giants pennant because Bobby Thompson might have gotten a signal on what pitch Branca was throwing because they were using a spyglass in the center field? It's stupid. You know, we make this argument in college sports all the time. Vacating wins, taking away titles is stupid. What, we didn't see the game? The game didn't happen? Those people didn't attend? You know, that money didn't transpire? I mean, come on. It's completely ridiculous. In college sports, if you want to make an impact on a program for doing something illicit, taking away wins is pointless. Taking away titles is pointless. You know, punishing kids on today's team for what happened 6 years ago, also stupid. You want to make it happen, you hit them in the pocketbook. That's where the college teams and the programs feel it the most. You hit them with monster fines. Baseball couldn't hit the Astros with anything bigger than a $5 million fine. Well, that's on baseball. That's their rules. Maybe they change those rules, you know, after this because you're going to have it with the Astros. We're going to have it again with the Red Sox in a month. So maybe that rule gets changed. But the idea of we got to take away a title or like this didn't happen or, you know, we're going to give it to the losers and in this case the Dodgers who are perennial playoff chokers. What, this is the only way they can get a title? Somebody's got to gift it to them? Get out of here.
I'll throw another current sports argument. So you mentioned all the past baseball ones. Let's throw it to football. Are you taking away the Patriots Super Bowl for Deflategate in the AFC Championship?
Please, you don't even have an asterisk next to, you know.
I'm a Patriots fan and bringing that up. So, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Let's look at if you go back to the NL MVPs for the last 20 years, there's a lot of guys who are suspected PED users and one guy who got flat out busted. Mm-hmm. And on Major League Baseball's website, how many asterisks do you think there are? Absolutely none.
Right. If Matt Kemp doesn't have Ryan Braun's award, then Aaron Judge shouldn't have Jose Altuve's award. Plain and simple, wipe that off the board. Let's get into, were you surprised that Crane fired Luno and Hinch right afterwards?
Honestly, I was surprised that they both got fired, especially, you know, for as good as this team is and as big as their window is, you got to remember, it's not even 2 months ago, Jim Crane pretty much ushered the Ryan family out of the organization. Reed Ryan was essentially removed as team president and now is a consultant. Nolan Ryan no longer has any affiliation with the Astros because Jim Crane decided he was going to make his son the new team president. It never made any sense to me. I understand he wants to have a plan of succession, but you're the owner. Your plan of succession is your will. You know, like, think about the idea of, you know, in football, right? Bob McNair did not make Cal McNair, you know, team president. He didn't fire Jamie Roots to make Cal McNair the team president. Cal was just with his dad, learned from his dad what being an owner is. Jim Crane's son didn't need to become team president to learn about being an owner. He could have shadowed his father for a year or two. Instead, they terminated a relationship with the Ryan family, you know, one of the most respected families in baseball. Now on top of that, so you've got inexperience at your team president. Now you've lost both your GM and your assistant GM, who was a total moron that you fired during the playoffs. But now you've lost your GM, who instituted the entire operational system of your organization. And you've lost one of the best managers in Major League Baseball. I mean, during the 2019 ALCS, it was all over Major League Baseball, MLB.com. All these stories about how A.J. Hinch outmanaged the pants off of Aaron Boone. So you've lost so much leadership. It is hard to replace all that. So, yeah, I was surprised that Jim Crane went that route. But if you – I guess if you peel the onion back a little bit and you see how Rob Manfred's statement, the very first thing he does before he starts, this is what they did, this is who I'm blaming, the very first thing he does is say, Jim Crane is innocent. That was job one. Jim Crane is 100% innocent. Well, how does Jim Crane show he's 100% innocent? He whacks everybody who's named.
Yeah, and my argument, people say, well, you didn't vacate the titles. I think the the statement Manfred gives, where basically says, Jeff Luhnow, you ran an awful culture with everything with Brandon Taubman, and you have the thing with Anthony Fenech with Justin Verlander, and how the Astros think they're better than everybody. That's more damning than taking the title away. That means you basically don't know how to run a franchise if you're a general manager. So I think Luno's never getting another job. I could see AJ Hinch getting another job.
You know, Ricky, I think Luno absolutely gets another job. But okay. To your point, there is validity to what you said, because this is something I've said for years. Luno is a brilliant guy as far as organization, structure, assessment, etc. He has zero social skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that trickled down the line, and by trickle, I mean was like the dam burst. His social inabilities to talk to people and relate to people, you know, that made its way through the entire organization to the point where, you know, people my age like to make fun of millennials. They don't know how to talk to anybody because they grew up texting. So they send texts and emails. They don't know how to actually speak. And Jeff Luhnow is a guy who, and if you ever watched him in front of a camera, nobody looks more uncomfortable speaking in front of a camera than Jeff Luhnow. He doesn't know how to relate to people. He only knows how to do his job. So in terms of will he get a job again, I think he's a guy who is perfect for running the operation, for doing the dirty work, for getting your information flow. He's just not a guy who should be in charge of other people.
I think I could definitely see that, but I also think AJ Hinch is going to get another job again, because I would have thrown out the perfect scenario, which is probably not going to happen now. We'll get into why in a little bit. I could have seen him being Beltran's bench coach in 2021 with his Stanford College buddy as general manager.
Well, I think AJ Hinch will definitely get another job as manager. He's proven himself too good to not get the opportunity. And one thing we've learned about sports, it doesn't matter what you do, whether mm-hmm. you smashed a monitor but didn't say, hey, stop using it, whether you beat your child, whether you beat a woman, whether you use PEDs, whether you get gun charges, it doesn't matter what you do. You get as many DUIs as you want. If you can be a valuable part of an on-field product or a front office product, you're always getting a second chance.
So let me get into the other big name in this report. Well, one of the other big names, Alex Cora. From your callers, well, two-part question. From your callers, is Alex Cora public enemy number one in Houston?
No, Mike Fiers is public enemy number one.
Ah, that's right. He's, okay, number one. Gotcha.
You know, Cora and Beltran, you know, they're the guys who are mentioned prominently. You know, and then, you know, it's funny, there's a video from the 2019 London series between yeah. the Yankees and the Red Sox, where the Yankees just pounded the hell out of Boston. And Alex Cora talks about the Yankees' best free agent acquisition was Carlos Beltran, and all the different things that he brings. And then he starts talking about devices, and he's winking, and he's laughing. And if you look back at that, you know, with 2020 glasses, man, that is great foreshadowing.
Well, both teams knew the signs for that game, considering it was like 25-21 those games, so it wouldn't work either way, regardless.
Oh, there was some slow pitch softball going on there, but it's just funny that here's Cora basically like talking junk to Beltran through the media, and nobody knew.
Mm-hmm.
And now we look back at it like, man, these guys are flaunting it right in front of everybody. It was like hiding in plain sight. So Alex Cora is not villain number one. Mike Fiers is villain number one because he's a rat. And it's funny, you know, Phil Garner was on radio locally here in Houston. He said, look, the guy's going to be looked at as a rat. If you had such a moral opposition to what was going on, why didn't you say anything when it was going on when you were there? You waited. You bore the fruit of everything. You got to get playoff shares. You got to get a World Series ring. Keep in mind, Mike Fiers has an axe to grind with the Astros because he was not on any of those playoff rosters because he was terrible in 2017. But he didn't give back his playoff shares, not giving back his World Series ring. He's just now 2 years later, well, let me drop the dime on them. Everybody who plays with this guy now knows, well, I probably can't trust him with anything.
So going into 2020, how do you view the Astros' chances of going back to the World Series? Yes, they lose Luno. Yes, they lose Hinch. Do you think Joe Espada is going to be the manager? Because it's kind of like an audition for him after he didn't get some jobs that he was finalist for this year.
I think it's a really interesting thing to watch here because the Astros are such an analytical team. You know, A.J. Hinch had earned his privileges, per se, with Jeff Luno. Joe Espada, I don't know who the new general manager is going to be. Jim Crane certainly feels, hey, I hired Luno. I can certainly hire another guy who's just as good. If you go down that road with these analytical guys, a lot of these highly analytical GM guys, they want a lot of input with the manager. You know, they kind of want to pull some strings. A guy like Joe Espada might be susceptible to a GM that wants to have a lot of influence. Depending on who the GM winds up being, I think will determine who's going to be the manager long term. Because if you have a GM who wants his manager to be more in control, they might go with a more seasoned, experienced manager to come in. Because it's kind of a difficult situation, maybe you want a guy who is a well-respected veteran manager who's had a lot of success. Dusty Baker certainly comes to mind. A guy who knows how to steer the ship. If you bring in a GM who, you know, wants all control over everything, maybe he keeps a guy like Joe Espada because he feels like he can control the manager to get him to do exactly what he wants.
So let's switch gears over to the Houston Texans. So before we get into specifics on the Chiefs game, is Houston's the Texans' 2019 season a success or a failure in your mind?
It's a failure. It's a big failure. You can't make the decision, A, we're going to dump our GM after a year because we're going to give our coach all power. Bill O'Brien is the most powerful man in the Houston Texans organization, not named McNair. You can't then turn around and make all those deals that you made, sacrifice all those draft picks, go all in, and you don't get any further than you've ever gotten before. If they didn't make the AFC title game, this season was a failure. To not make the title game in the spectacular, explosive, destructive fashion that they didn't make it is a super failure. The Texans have had spectacular playoff failures under Bill O'Brien. 30-0 against Kansas City, the beatdown by Indianapolis in their own building last year, and then the meltdown at Arrowhead on Sunday. What is Bill O'Brien other than playoff choker?
Yeah, I was trying to think of a better word to describe Sunday's game because it's not collapse, because collapse entails like you had a lead and then the other team came back late to win a close game. Meltdown's probably a better word, but there's got to be a word for you showed up to play the first 20 minutes and then forgot, oh yeah, we have to play another like 40 minutes on top of it.
That's kind of why I chose meltdown, because usually when you blow a 24-point lead, it happens in the second half, not in the second quarter. And O'Brien, I mean, really, and when I say playoff choker, this is basically like in a nutshell, right? Fourth and one from the Kansas City 13, you're up 21-0. You can kick the Chiefs right in the face. Kicks the field goal. Says he didn't have a fourth and one play. How do you not have a fourth and one play? I guarantee you Andy Reid's got a dozen of them. How do you not have one single fourth and one play that you like? That should be a fireable offense.
Yeah, these coaches have to have in their binder a tab for that.
If George Godsey was still the OC, he'd have been fired. You know, I don't know that Tim Kelly's going to get fired because Tim Kelly's not really the offensive coordinator. A former Texans wide receiver, Cecil Shorts, said he still talks to a lot of the guys in the locker room, and that the guys on the offense say Tim Kelly is the guy who comes up with all of the, you know, creative plays and whatnot, and Bill O'Brien just won't call them on Sundays. So, You know, when you go from 4th-and-1 to KC 13 and you've got no guts, you're kicking a field goal. But then 4th-and-4 from your own 30, after Kansas City's got a little bit of life, they just got a score, they had a big kick return, they get a touchdown, 4th-and-4. Now you're going to run a fake punt. You went from no guts to super drunk guts. And those are the things that you do when you're a playoff choker.
It's the small things with O'Brien, I feel like, because look at the week before. Going for it on 4th-and-1 when you could have kicked the field goal, gone up 6, you just got outmastered by a Bills team that also didn't know how to manage a game. That's always been the problem with O'Brien to me. He has no feel for the game. Makes always that one stupid decision that costs the team a game.
There are two reasons, and two reasons only, why the Texans beat the Buffalo Bills. Number one, Deshaun Watson is a magician. Number two, Josh Allen stinks.
Well, if Deshaun Watson's a machine, Pat Mahomes is a robot in my mind. He just makes plays that, like, you never see happen. So we got a magician and a robot playing in that game last week.
And that's it. You know, Josh Allen handed the game away to the Texans. Patrick Mahomes wasn't handing away anything.
No.
I mean, they were down 24-0, and he's laughing like, whatever, I got 3 quarters. I know I can score 30 points.
So, quickly, without a first-round pick, what do you think the Texans' biggest need is this offseason? Since O'Brien's not going to fire himself, what is the biggest need they have in your mind?
Well, the Texans really have to address a couple of things. Number one, they've got to address the pass rush. They signed Whitney Merciless to a $13 million a year deal. The guy, if J.J. Watt's not on the other side getting double-teamed, Whitney Merciless is on a milk carton. I don't know what goes on with J.J. J.J. got hurt this year. I thought going into this year, the fact that J.J.'s agent didn't make the Texans guarantee his salary, because J.J.'s playing on all non-guaranteed money. All the guaranteed money in his deal is up. That it was almost like agent malpractice to not have gone and gotten him a new deal. Well, J.J. winds up with the torn peg. Comes back 8 weeks later, and he's trying to play. After missing 8 weeks, does J.J. and his agent say, hey, look, we need guaranteed money? Or are the Texans now in a position where they might have to actually make a hard decision with J.J. Watt? This is 3 out of 4 years J.J.'s had a major injury. They don't get any pass rush if J.J. is not on the field. They also have to address the defensive secondary. Their pass defense is absolutely hideous. They have to address the secondary. You know, they traded for Gary and Conley. They picked up Hargraves. They got to make a decision with Roby. Jonathan Joseph, at the end of the season, had been marginalized to the point where he wasn't even playing. So there's going to be a lot of changes in their defensive secondary. They need cornerback help desperately. That is probably the number one thing for them is cornerback. And number two right now is probably pass rush. Number three might be right guard, because they've got to figure out what they're going to do there. I don't know if they're going to keep Zach Fulton. You know, Titus Howard's going to be the tackle. You got Laramie Tunsil at tackle. Max Sharping is going to be a guard. They extended Nick Martin at center. But that right guard spot, they're probably going to need to address that as well.
So last thing for you, Patrick. Who do you got in this week's conference championship games?
Well, I thought the 49ers were going to be the NFC representative all year long. I don't think that's going to change. I think San Francisco is going to stomp the hell out of Green Bay. It's almost like we've seen that before. And Tennessee's playing terrific ball, but the clock's going to strike 12 on the Tennessee Titans this week. Patrick Mahomes and that Chiefs offense, they're just – that team is going to run. And I just don't see how Tennessee can keep up with the points that they're going to put on the board. Having an offense built around a running game, and Derrick Henry's a phenomenal back. But at some point, you've got to score fast. Kansas City's going to make them have to score fast. And at that point, what do? Are they going to throw the ball? I can't see them beating Kansas City with 85 yards of passing offense.
Yeah, I was gonna say that too. Ryan Tannehill's gonna need at least 200+ yards to have a shot. The only thing I think that gives Tennessee a chance, I agree with you. Something about Aaron Rodgers in San Francisco I don't like, but Andy Reid, big game. It's hard to trust him.
I don't know. Did Andy Reid cost the Chiefs last year, or did Dee Ford cost the Chiefs last year?
Some might argue overtime cost the Chiefs last year, but that's a different point.
You know, I'm not gonna kill. I think Andy's got all the right pieces on that offense, mm-hmm. and he's probably the best offensive coach in the game, and has been for a long time. You know, to me, Kansas City's defensive deficiencies are far more of an issue for them than Andy, but I don't think that's coming up against Tennessee. They're playing a lot better defense the last 7 weeks. I mean, it's I don't know how long it lasts, but I do think that you saw Patrick Mahomes show you it doesn't matter what the other team does. He can go out and score every single time he touches the ball, and there's not a whole hell of a lot anybody can do about it.
So, Patrick, let the listeners know out there how they can catch your show, what you got going on down there, and how they can follow you on Twitter to listen to you on the radio.
All right, so I host Late Hits, ESPN 97.5, Houston, weeknights 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time. You can get the ESPN Houston app or check it out at ESPN975.com. On SB Nation Radio, midnight to 5 a.m. Central. On the SB Nation Radio app at SBNationLive.com. You can follow me on Twitter at PCreighton1.
Patrick, it's been a blast. Thanks for hopping on. Keep up the great work. We'll talk again soon. Thanks for the time.
No problem. My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, our special thanks to Patrick Creighton for hopping on the show, giving us his insight on the Astros scandal and the Houston Texans. And let's get into the NFL. Of course, we have the four divisional playoff games from this past weekend to take a look at, starting with the Vikings and 49ers. I'll go real quick because then we're going to get into the conference championship games this weekend. Niners were really impressed against the Vikings. We're going to have Ryan talk about it in a little bit. But they ran the ball very well. Tevin Coleman with 2 touchdowns. They shut down Dalvin Cook. The Niners got to Kirk Cousins. Vikings really, well, they were in the game till about the third quarter. The Niners dominated from start to finish. Didn't really need much from Jimmy Garoppolo. Their defense was impressive. So San Francisco, very convincing. Titans and Ravens was a big surprise. I really thought that the Ravens were going to be pulled away in this game. Derrick Henry was a beast, as he normally is, 30 carries, 195 yards. This game isn't really on Lamar Jackson. He had a decent game, threw 59 times, 365 yards and a touchdown, but did make a couple mistakes. I won't blame Lamar Jackson, but at the same time, the Ravens are 0-2 in Lamar Jackson playoff games. So an MVP year kind of gets ended earlier than a lot of people thought. Tennessee made big plays. John Harbaugh stayed aggressive, went for on 4th-and-1s, didn't get them. And Ryan Tannehill took advantage when he had the opportunity to for the Titans. So Tennessee, without really getting much from Tannehill, is in the AFC Championship. Their defense was great. And they continue that magical run they've been on, beating New England, beating Baltimore. We'll see what they can do in the AFC Championship game. Great job by Mike Vrabel, who, if you're the Patriots and Bill Belichick eventually moves on, I'd look to him to be your next head coach. Meanwhile, in Kansas City, Chiefs with a 51-31 win over the Texans on Sunday. Texans get up 24-0. I'm texting a friend of mine saying, what are the excuses? The Chiefs had no excuse to not to get to the Super Bowl after the Ravens lost. They start off bad. They drop a lot of passes, muff a couple punts. And the Texans screwed up in a span of a quarter. Patrick Mahomes is amazing. Nobody can deny that. Travis Kelce had 3 touchdowns. Bad job at the Texans. What are you doing running a fake punt? We talked about Patrick earlier. You're up 17 points. You don't need to do a fake punt, but you don't have a play call on 4th-and-1 when all these other coaches have probably tabs in their binders for like 3rd-and-5 or 3rd-and-7 or 2nd-and-6. You don't have a play for 4th-and-1 on the opponent's 13-yard line? That's crazy. So another disappointing loss for the Texans, and just when you thought their season was on track to a success, I can't think of collapse, because collapse would mean the Chiefs won the game late and the Texans almost won the game. This game was a different game after mid-second quarter. Collapse is a bad word for it. Finally, in Green Bay, Packers hung on 28-23. Aaron Rodgers didn't really have to throw the ball a lot, but he didn't have to. 16 of 27 for 243, 2 touchdowns, no picks. Aaron Jones gave him 2 touchdowns on the ground. Devontae Adams had a big game. And no shame for Seattle. Russell Wilson played great, 277 and a score. They didn't get much from the ground game outside of really Wilson. So give Russell Wilson credit getting Seattle almost to the NFC Championship game without their top two running backs. They made it a game at Lambeau, had a chance. You could argue about the first down call, but in the end, I don't think there was enough evidence to change it. So Packers find a way to win. They'll go to San Francisco for the NFC Championship. Very quickly, I'll give you my conference championship picks. I like the Niners over the Packers. I know different a second time around. San Francisco blew out the Packers the first time around. I think that Niners pass rush is just way too much for Green Bay. I think that Jimmy Garoppolo will do just enough to win this football game. I like the Niners double digits, but like 13 points maybe that they'll win by. I think their run game's too good right now. They could throw multiple backs at you. They're at home. They feel confident. For some reason Aaron Rodgers doesn't seem to play well in San Francisco either. So I'll give me the Niners to beat the Packers. Meanwhile, on the AFC side, 3:05 on CBS, Titans Chiefs at Arrowhead. Does Andy Reid get to his second Super Bowl as a head coach, or does he lose another big game? I'm going to say the Chiefs get there. I'm pulling for the Titans. It's a great story. Derrick Henry's been fantastic. Titans did beat the Chiefs earlier this year, but this seems to be a different Chiefs team as well. Patrick Mahomes is healthier than he was in that first matchup against Tennessee. Chiefs have everything clicking right now. It's tough for me to see them losing back-to-back years in the conference championship at home. And to me, they get Mahomes on a different level. They're going to get, I think, more from their run game with McCoy and Damian Williams. I think they get Tannehill, make a couple mistakes, and the Chiefs find a way to go to the Super Bowl. It would be Chiefs against 49ers. I think it would be a really good game. I call it the D Ford Bowl if that happens. So, again, I think Chiefs win the AFC, Niners win the NFC. So let's get in a little bit of further breakdown of the NFC Championship game. And to do that, my guest is Ryan Advergirata, the editor of Full Press 49ers. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Ryan, and then we'll get into the National Championship game. And joining me now on Kicking with Keeler is the managing editor of Full Press 49ers, getting set for the NFC Championship game this Sunday between the 49ers and the Packers. Ryan Advergirata is here. Ryan, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely happy to have you. So before we get into this breaking down the Niners and Packers, give me your takeaways from last week's dominating win the Niners had over the Vikings. What did you learn from that game? What impressed you about the way the Niners played?
Really, it came down to the fact that this team just seems locked in. Before the game, I know the NBC broadcast, Rodney Harrison, had talked about the team looked kind of too comfortable, too relaxed. Well, they came out on that Saturday game, and they just kind of came out on fire. And that's really the biggest takeaway for me, is just how locked in not just the players are, but just the coaching staff. You could see both Robert Saleh and Kyle Shanahan making adjustments on the fly really quick, you know, relatively quickly. Those adjustments worked like a charm. I mean, you hold – you know, Vikings running game basically to, I believe it was 18 yards the whole game. You know, you force them to throw the ball and you basically sack the quarterback 6 times. You know, the dominating defense, the run game for the 49ers just could not be stopped. And Kyle Shanahan saw what they were doing. They saw that, you know, he had 2 safeties up top, so he just kept running the football. And it was just a dominating performance, and it just showed how ready this team is for the playoffs right now.
Yeah, we'll get into Kyle Shanahan later, but one of the things I was very impressed by is I thought there was a lot of pressure on Kyle Shanahan in this game, because the last time we remember him from a playoff game was 28-3. So you wondered how much that would get into his head a little bit. And you, like you said, he called the perfect game. He didn't deviate from what was working all season long. And I think Falcons fans wished, hey, we could have ran the ball for 34 times in our Super Bowl and we would have won.
I mean, yeah, exactly. I remember fondly that game, watching it on TV, and just, you know, at one point kind of yelling at the screen, you know, just run the ball, you know, something as simple as that. And then them losing and then him getting the job for the 49ers, there was a lot of talk about, do you want to hire a coach that couldn't make such a simple, you know, adjustment in such a big game? But really, it came down to Sunday. I didn't really have too much of a worry about it. I know a lot of the 49er fans and the media didn't really have too much of a worry about it, because he's shown this season that he will do what it takes to win football games. And he might, he showed this season that, you know, he might struggle here and there for a few possessions, but he will tinker and tinker until that offense starts rolling. And I mean, they weren't the second highest scoring team in the league for for nothing. They were averaging over 25 points a game. So that tells you that he was calling just great offensive games this year.
So let's get a little bit into the NFC title game, Niners against the Packers. What's the confidence level amongst Niner fans going into this game?
I'll be honest, it's actually pretty high compared to what you would kind of think facing off against Aaron Rodgers the second time in the year. A lot of 49er fans really look at the previous game against them. I believe it was week 12, week 13, around there, where they had that dominating performance on Sunday night television. And they look at the fact that there was no D Ford there. There was no Quan Alexander there. So they look at the defense and how dominating they were, and then they throw in those guys who are back healthy. And it just becomes a scenario where you look at the defense is ready to really show and prove that they are the top defense in the NFL. And you have an offense that, let's be honest, the passing game in the last game didn't really do much, and they didn't need to. But, you know that Jimmy Garoppolo wants to put up some numbers, and there's a lot of confidence. I won't go into the realm of it's a guaranteed victory type of confidence, but there's a healthy confidence there with the understanding that this could be a very tough game. But people have a lot of faith in this team, especially with how they've been able to push through a lot of the adversity with injuries. And, you know, they were in last second ball games pretty much the last 5 weeks of the season. So they've shown that they have that fortitude to kind of see the game through.
Now, we're recording this on Wednesday, so obviously this could change. But with George Kittle not seen at practice, does that kind of change the confidence level a little bit?
Not going to lie, when that was first reported, when everyone noticed that he wasn't on there, there was a slight bit of panic. But from what everything that we've been able to discern from the discussions around the team after the initial news drop, it was more or less just a preventative measure where, hey, his ankle's a little tender. You know, he had that, I believe it was a fracture that he suffered earlier in the year. So it's just a matter of him getting some time off. As far as we know, there hasn't been any announcement of him really being like listed as questionable or anything like that. So with how well he played on Saturday, both in the passing game, even though he only had three catches, but primarily in the run game, you know, after the game was over, Kyle Shanahan said that there were no new injuries to report. So this might just be something where they just want to take it slow with him. It's the middle of the week. Just give him a little day off just to kind of stay off of it. But there were reports that he was walking around without a limp. So that right there kind of helps calm a lot of the fears.
So throughout the past years, not just this year, obviously we saw the Niners win 37-8 against the Packers earlier this year. Like you mentioned, Aaron Rodgers historically hasn't exactly played his greatest games against the 49ers, or Niners quarterbacks have fared so well against Green Bay, i.e. Colin Kaepernick. I believe Alex Smith had a good game against the Packers at one point. What makes the Niners so good against the Packers?
Really, I mean, when you're looking at this year's teams, I think a lot of it has to deal with the fact that the 49ers' strengths play to the Green Bay weaknesses. In the past, it did the same thing where you had, especially with Colin Kaepernick, you mentioned those games against the Packers, one in Candlestick and one was actually in Lambeau Field. It just came down to the Packers defense couldn't make stops when they needed to. And that's really what's going to come down to, I believe, on Sunday. It's can the Green Bay Packers defense make the stops as they need to? And especially when you look at this past, you know, this season right here, and we're looking at, you know, the fact that, yes, the 49ers, you know, put a whooping on Aaron Rodgers and the Packers earlier this year. You know, you take a look at it, and again, it's basically Aaron Rodgers, and he has weapons, but at the same time, they're relatively inconsistent. You know, they have a run game that looks like it could do stuff, but at times the offense just looks very sluggish. And when it comes on to the 49ers, especially their defense, you have to basically have your A game, especially along the offensive line. And with the people that are on that defensive line for the 49ers, there's just so much talent there that I just think especially this season. And even, I believe it was last year. It was either, I think it was last year or the year before that when they had Mike McCarthy there. The 49ers, as bad as they were those seasons, they still gave the Packers a lot of trouble. So I just think it's a matter of the personnel matches up in, you know, favorably for the 49ers.
So looking at Kyle Shanahan, like you mentioned earlier, how have you seen him grow as a head coach from the time he got to San Francisco to right now?
A lot of it, I feel like, comes down to he seems a lot more at ease. And it's weird to really point to that as the biggest change that you've seen. But, I mean, you look at his play calling. Yes, it's gotten better. I feel like it's something where the more you call plays, the more you figure out what works in your schemes, the better you're going to get in general. However, with him, it seems like throughout the game, he just makes a lot better decisions. You know, there's not too much gambling with him. However, when he does make the gambles, they seem to just line up perfectly for him. A lot of it just kind of comes down to the fact that his team is healthy now. I think he realized that for, you know, especially last season, the fact that they lost, you know, Jimmy Garoppolo so early and they basically had to play with two backups and they struggled. But I think last year when they had the Nick Mullins experiment and he played fairly well for a guy who is especially an undrafted free agent as quarterback, I think that allowed Kyle Shanahan to really recognize what worked in his schemes and not just, you know, have the idea that maybe he was helped a lot by the fact that he had Matt Ryan in the past. This time he has a guy who's an undrafted free agent and he's able to, you know, make the throws and he's able to get yards and put points on the board. I think that helped a lot just in the confidence, which is odd to say of a guy who basically was one drive away from winning a Super Bowl as an offensive coordinator. But as a head coach, I mean, he's just gotten better at calling the plays when they need to be called. I mean, just hitting on the right plays when they need those plays to hit.
So when you look at Shanahan's maturation, let's take a look at Jimmy Garoppolo's maturation. Didn't do much against the Vikings last game, just 131 yards, a touchdown and a pick on 11 for 19. There's times he's asked to do a lot, like game against New Orleans. There's times he's asked to do a little, but just not screw it up. It's been a little bit, I think, of both for him. How have you seen him improve in his first full season as quarterback?
Really, it's been quite the sight to see. I mean, at least from a fan standpoint, anyone watching him as a fan of either the 49ers or of Jimmy Garoppolo, when the season started, a lot of times he would throw the ball downfield. And obviously, if you're watching on television, you know, you're in such a zoomed in view that you don't necessarily see the secondary until the ball is traveling to that point. So a lot of times I'd be watching a game or someone I'd be around be watching the game and he'd throw a deeper pass and you could see the anticipation. I would probably say the anxiousness would come out from a lot of people seeing him throw deep passes, worried about interceptions. But the fact that you see him throw an interception and then he comes right back the next series and would just, you know, throw dots all over the field and throw a touchdown all of a sudden. It's the ability for him to just come back after adversity. Okay, well, he fumbled the football, no problem. I'll leave the team down for a game tying or a game winning drive. You know, as poorly as he played against Seattle on that Monday night game, he was still the main reason why they came back and they were able to force overtime. I mean, he led the team down the field. You know, he was taking a beating, but he stays in the pocket. You know, you see him just becoming that leader without having to say anything. And I think that's the biggest thing is you see him now in a full season as a starting quarterback, and you just see how good he can be and really how good he can lead a team.
Yeah, I think that was the big question mark with him, at least with New England, when he had that limited sample size, was can he stay healthy, which he has, coming off the terrible injury. And I think also, like you said, he just doesn't do too much for the football. He's very consistent. He doesn't really have those phases in the game where his play just randomly drops off. And as we saw against New Orleans, we saw against Seattle, there's times where he can take over, but then there's also times where, like, you know what, the running game's working. I'm just going to keep running handing off the football and let my team take care of it. It just seems like there's not a lot of ego with him, and I think that's a great thing to have for a franchise quarterback.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, he came in and since he's been in the league, you know, he's been talked about, you know, they call him Jimmy GQ, all that type of thing. So you would think he would have that big ego, but I mean, the guy on a reverse play last week put a pancake block on, on Anthony Barr, you know, a linebacker. So he was willing to get his hands dirty to block, you know. He was interviewed, I believe it was either yesterday or today, and he talked about the fact that, you know, last year he had that injury. And as bad as it was that he got that injury, he looks at it as a blessing because they were able to get Nick Bosa. That tells you a lot about this quarterback. It tells you a lot about the player and the man. The fact that he looks at something that took away time from his career, you know, the ability to play and prove himself and really make more money. And realistically, he just looks at the team and he just wants the team to win. And you can see that buy-in, not just from him, but everyone else on that team.
So let's take a look. I think when you look at the Niners, you talk about Garoppolo, you talk about Shanahan. I feel like the one guy that gets overlooked in everything is John Lynch. I just feel like there's not a lot of national talk for him now. He did get the number two pick and took Nick Bosa, which everybody says, well, that's the easy pick. But he's made some really good moves, Jim. Traded for Richard Sherman, drafted Deebo Samuel, traded for Emmanuel Sanders. I just feel like John Lynch has gone overlooked for the job he's done. We talk about the moves like the Ravens made, things like that. But I feel like there's not a lot of national publicity around John Lynch for the job he's done there.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, John Lynch, at the end of the day, is the guy who had the final say. You know, he makes the decision. The thing that he does well that I feel people don't give him credit for is he brings different voices and opinions to the table. He listens to what they say. And, you know, he takes it into consideration. He may not go with the idea of Kyle Shanahan every single time, but he's going to talk to Kyle Shanahan every single time. And he builds that relationships with not just his coaching staff, but the rest of the front office. You know, a lot of people point to Adam Peters as being the guy behind the scenes who makes all these moves. And while it helps you, you have to remember who brought him in, you know, who brought these people around Kyle Shanahan and who closed the deal really to bring in Kyle Shanahan. And that was John Lynch. So, you know, John Lynch decided to build the defense, the 49ers defense, in the image of the defenses that he played in when he was at Tampa Bay. And you can see that in the defensive line, how talented they are. You can see that in the speed in the linebacker group, and you can see it in the secondary. You know, they know what they want, they know what they need. And for instance, you mentioned that picking Deebo Samuel, you know, that was an exciting pick. There were a lot of concerns about him being healthy, but he's healthy and he has just been really just a great pickup. I mean, the guy realistically should have been part of the, you know, all rookie team. He's someone who you can see being really just a cornerstone of this 49ers offense. And you mentioned it too, you know, signing Richard Sherman, trading for Emmanuel Sanders. And you look at how those moves, while they were talked about a lot during, you know, the point that they were made, they weren't necessarily looked at as good moves. You know, they looked at, okay, well, you're signing Richard Sherman off of a Achilles injury. You're trading for Emmanuel Sanders. Why didn't you go after Mohamed Sanu? Well, look how that turned out. So stuff like that where, you know, they were talked about at the time, but they were more talked about in more of a disrespectful manner. And you look at him now and, you know, he's basically been the driving force to build this team. And they're sitting one game away from a Super Bowl visit.
So the Niners, what are their strengths? What they did against the Packers, they sacked Aaron Rodgers 5 times in the first game. You had 2 sacks of Merrick Armstead. You had – this is a game – I don't think Nick Bosa did have a sack as well. One of the things I know from talking with people, you like to talk about defensive line plays. I'll let you have the floor here. What do you love the most about the Niners' defensive line?
So, yeah, my favorite thing about this team is the defensive line. And part of it obviously comes – from the fact that I just love talking about linemen, but it also comes from the fact that you look at this defensive line and there's just so much talent, but there's so much versatility. And a lot of it comes down to how they're used. First of all, as much as was talked about that the 49ers run a wide 9 on the defensive front, they'll change it up. You know, they'll move their guys inside. They'll stack them if they have to. But really what it comes down to is you can have Nick Bosa play the wide 9 position outside of that of the tight end. You can have him over the tackle. You can have him even playing the 3 technique over the guard. But the same thing goes for DeForest Buckner, Eric Armstead, even Solomon Thomas, for as much as his career so far has kind of been made fun of. You know, he's seen a resurgence this year. And a lot of it just comes down to they're putting their defensive linemen in position to make, you know, to make plays. And yes, a lot of it comes down to the fact that you have an embarrassment of riches where you have Dee Ford as a first round pick, Eric Armstead, first round pick. You have five first round picks on that defensive line, in that defensive lineman room. And then you also have other guys who would probably be starting for a lot of other teams. And they can rotate those guys when healthy. And we saw it last week against the Vikings. This defensive line will rotate about seven guys total. You know, they'll play those seven guys. And because of that, you have Dee Ford playing basically 20-25% of the snaps, and it keeps him fresh, and he's able to come off the edge. Nick Bosa plays about 70% of the time. So that means you have a lot fresher bodies, and really it's just fun watching them play. I mean, they feed off of each other, and they're a scary bunch, and they have a lot of attitude.
So when you take a look at this game, give me your X factor and your number one key to the NFC Championship.
The biggest key, what I feel like is going to be who, and this is going to be the same thing that I looked at last week when they played the Vikings, it's which ground game is able to control the football. So if the 49ers get their way and they can run the football pretty much just like they did the last time these two teams played, it's obviously going to come out in favor of the 49ers. If the Packers can slow down the pass rush with the ground game, force them to, you know, maybe slow down on their pass rush just in case they're trying to run the football, you know, that's going to be a major key, is basically trying to see who wins that battle. But as far as X factors are concerned, I think it's actually going to come down to the offensive line for the 49ers. You know, the Packers pass rush has been very streaky this year. You know, you basically have the Smiths and you have Kenny Clark, and it's going to come down to, can the 49ers offensive line do the job? Can they control the line of scrimmage? Can they give Jimmy Garoppolo time to throw the football? If that answer is yes, then I don't see the 49ers losing.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. I think this game comes down to which rushing attack is better. I mean, you look at that first matchup, the Packers, the leading rusher was Jamal Williams, which is a surprise considering how great Aaron Jones has been this season. And I think also it comes down to which number two receiving target plays better, because you know Devontae Adams is going to get his. You kind of know George Kittle, with the exception of last week, is going to get his. Is it one of the Packers' number two wide receivers between Allison, Valdes-Scantling, Graham, mixing a couple guys? Or for the Niners, is it Samuel? Is it Kendrick Bourne, who had a touchdown last week? Is it Sanders? Which complementary receivers make those big plays when the defense takes the number one option out of it, I think is going to be big.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the big thing, is when you talk about, you know, which receiving option is going to step up after the top guy, that's going to come down to the play callers. And you have Matt LaFleur and you have Kyle Shanahan, who's going to scheme their guys open. And that's why I have a difficult time, you know, believing that, or not necessarily believing, but just seeing the 49ers losing this game, is because it comes down to, I believe more in Kyle Shanahan's ability to scheme his players open than I do Matt LaFleur, especially against this 49ers defense.
Plus, how much did the Niners pick the brain out of Mike LaFleur to see what Matt's doing? That also
exactly.
Was fun.
Exactly. I mean, that's, you know, that needs to be talked about as well. But, and also the fact that, you know, these two guys used to work together. You know, Matt LaFleur worked under Kyle Shanahan. So they run, you know, similar schemes. I mean, you have McVay, Shanahan, and LaFleur were all on the same staff in Washington. So they run similar schemes. Kyle Shanahan, I would probably put above the other two, as he's shown the ability to have his offense run no matter who's the quarterback. But that's what it's going to come down to. And that familiarity is going to basically, you know, give that much more of an edge, I feel like, for the 49ers.
So I'm sure I probably know where you're going for this, but who wins this game and why?
Yeah, if you haven't figured out by now, yeah, I'm picking the 49ers. I don't think it's going to be the same, similar to the same score. I think it's going to be slightly closer. But barring just a very subpar game from the 49ers, and I don't mean a B game either. I mean like their C game, their D game. And that would require the Packers to play their A game. And I just don't see the Packers playing their best on the road in Santa Clara at Levi's Stadium. That place is going to be sold out. That place is going to be wild. They've started to call it the Santa Clara Zoo now. So that place is going to be crazy. But I just can't see the 49ers really fumbling this game unless, you know, and I I don't want to talk about it very much, but unless you see something like the 2011 NFC Championship game where just they just turned the ball over, that's really the only scenario I can see the Packers winning. So my pick really is going to come down to the 49ers, and I can see it being a 33-17 game.
So who are they playing in Miami then, if I ask you for a quick bonus pick?
You know what? It's hard for me to not pick the Chiefs just because that offense is just so scary. And ever since they picked up, you know, everyone been getting healthy on the Chiefs defense, and they have Terrell Suggs now, and they just seem a lot better. But I have this feeling that if the Titans are going to get there, I mean, it's the common theme in the playoffs, right? You get a wild card team gets hot at the end of the season, and they ride a defense and like a running back or something to the Super Bowl. That said, I do think it's going to be the 49ers versus the Chiefs. As much as I would love to see, you know, Derrick Henry, in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I'm imagining all the prop bets between Jimmy Garoppolo and Ryan Tannehill, and that would be some real interesting quarterback prop bets going forward. But we'll see what happens in this weekend's game. So, Ryan, give listeners out there what you got going on at Full Press 49ers, what coverage you got for the game, and how they can follow you on Twitter.
Yeah, so Full Press coverage, 49ers. You know, if you're just a fan of football, if you're a fan of just about every sport, honestly, we cover it, even wrestling. So by all means, check out the site, fullpresscoverage.com. But also this week, you know, we already went over the keys from the win against the Vikings. Tomorrow we're going to drop the basically the three biggest keys you're going to be looking at for a 49ers victory. And also we're going to be working with the Full Press coverage Packers team on Friday and Saturday to kind of go over the game to really see what's going on. So, you know, obviously head over there. You can follow me personally at Ryan @Verada on Twitter. Or if it's easier to spell, FPC_49ers. You can go ahead, give us a follow, chat us up. A lot of fun things happening. And really, you know, I love this time of the year. It's weird. It's been a while since I've been able to enjoy the playoffs like I've been able to so far. But, everyone, you know, by all means, it's been fun. And hopefully the ride continues.
Go to Full Press Coverage 49ers. Check out their work, including the ones with Full Press Packers. We've had Kyle on this year, both good people. So definitely check out the work so far from those two sites. Ryan, thanks for hopping on. Keep up the great work. Enjoy Sunday, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks for the time.
Thank you very much, Ricky.
My special thanks to Ryan @Verada for hopping on to talk about the 49ers and their NFC Championship game against the Packers. Finally, let's get into the national championship game, and I thought Joe Burrow put on an absolute clinic. You couldn't ask for much better than what Joe Burrow did. LSU was just, quite frankly, the better football team. And I said last week, I thought if this game was played anywhere but New Orleans, I thought Clemson had a shot. And Trevor Lawrence doesn't even throw a touchdown. He runs for a touchdown. I thought Clemson did a good job on the ground. And this game was close up until the third quarter. But Burrow was just two lights out, 31-49, 463, five touchdowns, no picks, runs for a touchdown. Clyde Edwards-Helaire had 110 yards rushing. Ja'Marr Chase and Justin Jefferson just too unstoppable. Jefferson's going to the draft. You'll be interested to see where he goes. Chase comes back next year, although LSU now loses Joe Brady. The offensive coordinator now goes to Carolina. They're likely going to lose their defensive coordinator. A lot of reports I saw, I forget who had it first. Dave Aranda is going to take the Baylor job in all likelihood. So LSU's going to get a little bit of a coaching search change in 2020. I'm going to get real quick who had the Dave Aranda news. But Joe Burrow had one of the best seasons ever for, I believe it was Bruce Feldman. Yeah, Bruce Feldman got it from Fox Sports and The Athletic. Joe Burrow had one of the best seasons in college football history. And he's going to be the number one pick. He should be the number one pick. The Bengals are going to be happy with him. I don't know what Burrow is going to be at the next level, but I know in college football, he was fun to watch. LSU's defense made plays when they had to. They weren't the greatest defense in the world, but they were able to get the stops when they needed to. I think that makes a difference. And to me, you look at Clemson, Trevor Lawrence will be back next year. He's going to have a shot at another national championship. Clemson should be back in the playoff. No shame in losing this football game, but LSU was just way too good. And congrats to Ed Orgeron, who took a lot of hit from the jobs he had at USC and Ole Miss. Nobody thought he could do this at LSU. He did it. It's so fun to watch him coach. I love his accent. I love his enthusiasm, his personality. And LSU's going to be, hopefully we'll see what they do at quarterback, but should be right back in the mix next year with Alabama, who doesn't have Tua now next year either. So should be fun times in the SEC next year, now that Mike Leach, we talked about last week, is in it too. So SEC football, a lot of fun. Of course, we talked about it earlier, the Odell Beckham situation. What are you doing handing out money? I know that everybody hates the rules that these players don't get paid. That doesn't give you the excuse to say, here, take a couple dollars. You know the rules. You can't do that. Just like you can't slap behind of a police officer. What are you doing? I don't get it. I really don't get it. I want to get real quick into some college basketball as well. Lots been going on in college basketball. We talked to Amy McKenna a couple weeks ago from Tiger Vision, and we kind of talked about the idea of what if Clemson beat North Carolina and Duke in college basketball. They did. You have a case where last night Auburn took its first loss to Alabama, so there's only one undefeated now in college basketball. That's San Diego State. You saw Duke lost to Clemson, as I mentioned. Kansas took a loss to Baylor over the weekend. Baylor got a nice win in it on the road in Lawrence. So Baylor playing some good basketball. You have, I think, a team like Seton Hall is one to watch. Went into Butler on Wednesday, got a big win. Miles Powell is one of the best scorers in the country. So college basketball is getting really, really exciting. And what we talked about a few weeks ago, I don't think there's a clear-cut number one in college basketball. And that's going to make March Madness so exciting in 2 months. So we're going to have so much to talk about next week. We're going to have the situation where we're going to talk about the conference championship games. We're going to get more into the sign-stealing scandal, who the Astros pick as manager, who the Red Sox pick as manager, who the Mets pick as manager. You're going to have a situation where you have MLB Hall of Fame voting. We're going to get into that. We're going to have Senior Bowl coverage. I don't know how much I'll get into that, but we'll talk about that a little bit. And we'll have our Super Bowl matchup to talk about a little bit. We'll do a quick preview of it. We're not going to go too crazy. And Zion Williamson comes back next week to make his NBA debut. So that should be a lot of fun coming in the days and weeks to come. So again, follow me on Twitter, at RickNader555. You can follow the radio station on Twitter, at Full Press Radio. You can follow Full Press Coverage at FP Coverage. We have sites for everything, so please feel free to check it out. We are on iTunes as well, as I mentioned, so please feel free to give a 1-star or 5-star rating, subscribe, like the podcast. We definitely want to hear your feedback. We definitely appreciate it. Again, my thanks to Patrick Creighton and Ryan Adverdorada for coming on the show to talk about the Astros and Texans in Patrick's case and the Niners in Ryan's case. We'll hopefully have some more guests for you next week. So from all of us here at Full Press Coverage, this has been Ricky Keeler saying have a great weekend. Enjoy the conference championship games. And thanks for kicking it with me, Ricky Keeler. I'll see you next time.